Books Present and Future today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Mouton. Today we're going to suggest some books we'd like to read, and we hope you will too, on Scribble. You know, there's so many books I want to read that I will never read.
How many did you read last year? Do you have any idea?
No idea. No idea at all. Mainly because the books I decided to read were so thick.
You did read some. Well, so did I. But I got through, I figure out, maybe 70 to 75 books.
Holy mackerel.
Out of, what, the 700,000 published in the United States last year?
Yeah, I know. It's And the thing is, as I mentioned many times before, I read these literary journals, and I read magazines. I read magazines. Some come every day, and I at least page through them to see what they've got, and if it's something that I really ought to read, then I read it. But the literary journals are killers because they just take forever.
They do.
And when you've read some of those British summations, you figure you've read the book.
Right.
But I never stop pawing through these. I was looking at the Edward R. Hamilton catalog, and I saw a book I prize greatly by Jennifer Homans. It's called Apollo's Angels. Mm. I bought it for $35. It sells for about a quarter of that now.
Right.
And if you would ever read any book on ballet, this is the one. It covers the whole field. It's easy to read. It doesn't miss anybody, and it just changed my whole way of thinking about the discipline. But, yeah, that was then. This is now. What have you been reading?
Well, this past year I have read, as I said, something maybe about 75 books. But I've picked out for my list of what I've read that I really remember a wide variety of books. For instance, I normally never read the bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
You know, and the longer they're on there, the less I'm inclined to read them. But I decided, given the pandemic and the different times, that I would read the one that's been on at least for 75, 80 weeks. Where the Crawdad Sings by Delia Owens.
Oh, yeah.
And it is surprisingly a good read.
Yeah.
It takes place in a swamp in North Carolina where a young girl, 12, I think, when we first meet her, her mother has abandoned. They live out in the swamp in the woods by themselves in a shack, fish for a living. Her mother abandons the family. Her father is alcoholic. It's, you know, six of one, half a dozen another, whether things are better when he's home or when he's gone on one of his toots for several months. So she's forced from the very beginning to live by herself, make her own living. She collects mussels and sells them to another little shack. There's a little black community nearby. But she learns about life. She's never been to school. She learns about life by watching nature. And first of all, it is a really haunting picture of a swamp. Uh-huh. And at the same time, it's a beautiful picture of a young girl growing up under incredibly unusual circumstances. And I don't want to say any more because most of my readers have probably read it long before I did. But anyway, that was a pleasant surprise.
Well, mine, the only one I read was Deacon King Kong. And I got such a blast out of that I tell everybody, you ought to read this book.
Define blast.
Huh?
Define blast.
Just exhilaration all the way through. I was intrigued of the way the story was put together, but the characters were so vivid, I just couldn't get past it. And the way they spoke was convincing and idiomatic. It was just terrific.
You know, I read reviews of that book when it first came out, and it got very good reviews, although it seems to have fallen off the face of the earth recently. But the title just didn't appeal to me. Deacon King Kong, what's that about? Until you gave me a copy.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'll read it. And it's probably the best novel I've read all year.
It is exceptional, isn't it?
Now, can I ask you one question without giving the plot? I think the more I think about this book, the better and better it gets. One of the props in this book is a small black Baptist church, on the outside of which someone had once painted a huge copy of a Renaissance portrait of Jesus, which somebody has painted black and then written over it, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. How are we to take that phrase, do you think?
What? What's that?
May God hold you in the palm of his hand.
What about the phrase?
Well, is that...
Well, that was the key.
Is that sarcastic?
No. No, I think that was the key. Because as the plot develops, you suddenly realize that's what it was all about.
I know, but I'm taking it on a higher level. Anyway... I have thought more and more about that phrase in relation to this. You know, when I first started reading it, it sounded like a blast, too, and it reminded me a lot of Steinbeck's Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday, where he deals with a bunch of bums and no accounts living down on the waterfront, you know, out in California. But I think this is a lot better book than people are going to take it for. It's going to catch on, I think.
I would hope so, but as a Southerner, I'm always alert to racism. And the fact that it's a black author, it's about black people, I don't think many people would believe that, well, this relates to me. It really does. These are real people, and they live on the dark side of life. And God does hold them in the palm of his hand.
I'm not even sure they live on the dark side.
What we would consider the dark side of life. They live in a ghetto.
You know, we're going to end up discussing the whole half hour of this particular book. Read it for yourself.
That's right. Read it for yourself.
And then let me know what you think of it. Because this is one of those books that I give to people. And I say, I want to know what I want to know what you think. What do you think? I'd love to discuss it.
Well, the redemption in it is just... beautiful. But let me leap ahead. There are some books coming out next month, one of which I have already talked about in my column, and that is Metazoa, Animal Life and the Birth of Mind. As if anybody who's read much of what I've written or listened to me, you know that I'm fascinated with consciousness, with self-awareness. What does it amount to? And why is it we can only know so much and no more? But we keep looking for answers. And I was fascinated by Teilhard de Chardin when he put consciousness in matter, and it was the elaboration of matter through evolution that gave us this incredibly complex brain. But then you think, if this is true, that consciousness was there, some form of it, all the way through, and as it became more complex, then it began to rise. Well, shouldn't it have risen through animals? Don't animals have some degree of consciousness? We like to think of them as unthinking, unfeeling. That's not true.
You know, that book is on my list, too.
Yeah, Metazoa, and Animal Life and the Birth of the Mind. And related to that, there's another one that is coming out next month. What Do Animals Think and Feel? An Investigation into Emotional Behavior by Carsten Brensing. By the way, I should mention that Metazoa is by Peter Godfrey Smith. If you don't have something to write with, get it, because we're going to mention a lot of stuff. But What Do Animals Think and Feel by Brensing? Carsten goes into some detail, even into the sexual life of animals, and how some of the things we consider aberrant in humans exist in animals too. And it, I won't go into detail because there's a certain delicacy involved here, but it is amazing the incredible social life that animals have. And a lot of it seems to parallel, or at least be a prelude to our lives.
When I was just starting to teach at Augustana, the most prominent naturalist writing was Joseph Wood Crouch. And we had in our freshman English text an essay of his called Love in the Desert, in which he, way back in 1960, explores the very things you're talking about. And it's his claim, it's an essay worth going back to read, that that it is in the nature of nature to try out every simple possible combination of everything.
That's true. I was interested to read a long time ago about how Indians, Native Americans, handled homosexuality. They just rode with it. You know, they just let people be who they are and not worry about it. And it took us a long time to come around to that. There's also another book I want to mention. Say, I go for science. Every Breath You Take, Exploring the Science of Our Changing Atmosphere. That's coming out next month, too. I should mention, by the way, that Metazoa won't be out until November. But Every Breath You Take really gives you pretty much a good idea of the atmosphere from the very top of it all the way down to Earth, how it functions, how breathing works. Mark Brumfield takes you through the gaseous planets, their atmosphere all the way down, and he helps you understand what it's like to breathe at the Himalayas and down at the surface of the Earth and below the water. If you're interested in our changing atmosphere, and Lord knows it's changing in a dramatic and sometimes catastrophic way, you might want to look out for that. Every Breath You Take by Carsten Brumfield, Brumfield. And now that you've gotten something to write with, let me repeat Metazoa by Peter Godfrey Smith. That's a hyphenated last name. And What Do Animals Think and Feel by Carsten Brensing, Brensing. Back to you, sir.
Well, I think next book I'm dying to read is already out, but when I started looking, it was coming. It's a novel called Pew, P-E-W, by Catherine Lacey. And apparently it's the story of one Sunday morning in a small southern town, in a small church in that town. The congregation arrives to find a homeless person asleep on the pew. It happens to be a week in which this particular church, or I guess the whole town, organizes a thing called the Festival of Forgiveness. And so all these church members, of course, know what they're supposed to do when you meet a homeless person who is just sleeping there because he doesn't have any place else to go, or she. And so they decide to practice Christian charity on this person, take care of him, feed, or him or her. It's not clear whether this is a male or female. It's not clear whether this person is black or white or what race. It's not clear even how old this person is, because this person, who incidentally is the narrator apparently of the story, doesn't talk and will not answer their questions. Who are you? You know, well, which bathroom would you like to use? It turns out that everybody is dying to practice Christian charity, but you can only do that so far, right?
Before, yeah.
and so it seems to me like it's going to be a modern version of Mark Twain's The Man That Corrupted Hadleyburg, this guy that comes into town and screws up the whole town. I have no idea how a person who doesn't talk can be a narrator of a novel, but anyway, I am Catherine Lacey's Pew, P-E-W. It sounds like it's just my kind of book to sit there and think about and think about.
It reminds me of Bernard Shaw. Christianity is a wonderful idea. It's a pity it's never been tried.
Right.
And that is so terribly true, because Christianity is tough. You look at the Lord's Prayer. I've written about this, you know. Forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against us. You're not asking for mercy. You're saying, don't treat me any better than I treat others.
Right.
That's a hard bargain.
Right.
Well,
now, you like science, but I like nature.
Okay.
And the next book, and I think this is already also out, but I am dying to read it, is called Desert Notebooks by Ben Ehrenreich. E-H-R-E-N-R-I-E-C-H, Ehrenreich. He is the writer on climate change for The Nation. He's written for The New Yorker and other New York Times and other magazines like that. But it turns out that he spent some time, he and his live-in girlfriend, spent some time living in a little shack out by themselves about a mile from the Joshua Tree National Monument, out in the desert, absolutely empty. Against the backdrop of the desert and its raw meaning are all the modern problems that we have, from politics and President Trump, whom he calls the rhino, down to climate change and all sorts of things like that, back and forth. There's a chapter called Las Vegas. He had a fellowship at a university in Las Vegas, so he spent a semester there, and that gets contrasted with the desert. And the reason I'm fascinated by this is not only that it has to do with nature, but the desert has always captivated me. And I am not able to explain it. A student group was going from Santiago up to Arica, the northern coast of Chile, along the Pacific Ocean, through the Atacama Desert, where it has never rained in recorded history. And we would make one of our stops to go to the bathroom, girls on one side, boys on the other of the bus. And I stood there looking at that desert, which is absolutely barren. It's grays and light blues and browns, and it stretches endlessly out toward the Pacific Ocean. I had all I could do to keep from starting out and walking, just walking out into the desert. And I never would have done that, but there was a real temptation there. Charles Darwin, when in The Voyage of the Beagle, describes going out in Patagonia, pretending to have a gun to hunt, but just sitting there absorbing what he calls no place. And he has a great chapter in his book, The Voyage of the Beagle, on the attraction of no place on this earth. It's not lush, it's not tropical, it's not beautiful, but there's something about it that's haunting. And so I hope to really find, you know, a kin in this particular book, Desert Notebooks by Ben Ehrenreich.
Well, you know, that's what's happened to Teilhard de Chardin, sitting in the Gobi Desert. He suddenly saw it throbbing with life and began to develop his ideas.
Well, the great religions, right, are all desert fathers.
That's true. Along that, somewhat off to the side, there's a book that came out this month called Weird Earth, Debunking Strange Ideas About Our Planet. Interesting idea. A guy named Donald R. Prothero, P-R-O-T-H-E-R-O, gathered together all the really dumb things people have come up with to explain the planet. Myths like the young Earth creationism, the Flat Earth Society, a theory that somehow Hollywood faked the moon landings, healing crystals, those who think the Earth is hollow. It's amazing. Some people who think that the paleontology is all a lie. I think what's interesting about putting all those together in one book, it'll make you think about your own weird ideas.
Right.
Weird Ideas, Debunking Strange Ideas About Our Planet by Prothero. All right. I have music. What do you have?
Well, I didn't think have we totally left the books we've read this past year?
No.
Well, because I want to go back to some real finds this year. I came across a phrase by John Werner, who's the writes reviews for the Wall Street Journal and the Chicago Tribune, about a writer named Charles Portis, P-O-R-T-I-S. Have you ever heard of Charles Portis?
No, I haven't.
Wherein he is called the greatest unknown novelist, American novelist. And it turns out that Charles Portis lived in Arkansas, wrote four books, one of which was True Grit. I didn't even realize that was a novel before John Wayne got a hold of it and turned it into a movie. And it's a very good soul. Warner suggests that the book to read by Portis is Dog of the South, which I got a hold of a copy, and it is a delightful romp. I can see why Portis is the unknown American novel. That may be a stretch, but this is a very good book, and it's really worth reading. It doesn't really have much of a plot. A young man in a southern city wakes up one morning to find that his wife has left with his best friend and his car and his credit card and headed out, left him. And he wants the car back. So,
his car.
His name is Ray Midge, which is just a perfect name. So Ray Midge sits around for a couple months waiting for the credit card bills to start coming in to see where the heck they might be, and discovers that they've headed south into Mexico and from Mexico down into Central America and eventually to Belize and Honduras. And so he decides to trail him in a car that barely works. And along the way, meets a cast of characters, you know, a shyster doctor and a woman evangelist and other people that are just delightful. I mean, it is funny. It's incredible. The guy can really write. And I have never heard of him.
Yeah.
I love finding somebody like that. And it's a good year when I find somebody that I'd never even heard of who turns out to be this good. Charles Portis, P-O-R-T-I-S, Dog of the South.
There are a couple of books that I would recommend. One has been out for some time. It's called Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of the United States Nationhood. It's by Colin Woodard. W-O-O-D-A-R-D. He picks two people, George Bancroft, who was a U.S. Navy secretary and historian, and William Gilmore Sims, who was a slavery novelist and a politician. And he takes their view of the country. Bancroft saw national character through the lens of belief in personal freedom, equality before the law, and Republican governance. And Sims saw it really through Anglo-Saxon ethnic and racial chauvinism. And I think those two things are splitting the country again today. How do you forge a nation? What is it? Is it based on ideals of personal freedom and so on? Or are you looking for something like a closed society that just favors your group? There's another book that came out just this last month called Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. He quotes Madison's idea of pluralism, that the country is a broad diversity of interests and groups across a federal union, which helps prevent any one interest or group attain dangerous dominance. And it seems to me we're always in that fix.
Right.
You know, that we don't really want equality so much as we want preferential treatment for who we happen to be. And it's very hard to kind of stuff the latter feeling into a sack and get along with everybody. But those are books well worth reading. Union by Colin Woodard and Divided We Fall by David French.
Well, you gave me a Publisher's Weekly that listed the forthcoming books for this fall, of which I've gone through, and in addition to the ones I already wanted, I have picked a few more. But I was intrigued by the fact that the issue you gave me says we're going to list the best 834 forthcoming books, of which we've mentioned four so far. 834, the best books, right, in every different category, romance, you know, mystery, fiction,
science. Know, that's true. You look at Publishers Weekly, and they pick out certain books that they think are going to be quite successful and worth reading, but they cannot possibly talk about all the books that are published. So you're left with their choices.
And how many of the 834 are you and I going to read? Well, the one I'm going to read is Marilynne Robinson is out with book number 4 in her Gilead series.
Oh,
this
yeah.
one is Jack. It takes the son and a love affair that he has that goes wrong. If you're a fan of Marilynne Robinson, who lives and teaches at the University of Iowa, and whose first book, Gilead, in this series is a small-town minister and his family, I've really become a fan of Marilynne Robinson. I postponed reading her again because she was so popular on so many bestseller lists, but I really have gotten to like her.
Yeah.
And then I thought we need to mention a poem or two. Billy Collins is coming out with a new book this fall of poems called Whale Day and Other Poems. And so I just want to mention that because I know how many people like Billy Collins. I was at a friend of mine was in Atlanta when Billy Collins came to read, and there were 1,500 people in the audience.
Yeah.
You know, for a poet to do that is absolutely astounding.
Well, just briefly mention, we're running out of time here, but there's a book coming out next month called Memphis Mayhem. If you're interested in the history of rock, this talks about Sun Records, Stax Records, HG, and all the popular performers associated with them, because that was quite a revolution in music. And then there's a book that is out already called Wagnerism, Art and Politics in the Shadow of Music. How this overwhelmingly persuasive music of Wagner has influenced so many different people in different ways. For Hitler, he was the man because of his mythic view of Germany and his anti-Semitism. But you find partisans of his music among the Jewish population and really scattered all over. So Wagner had quite an impact. And there's something about his music that really gets to people, certainly gets to me. And we're getting to the end here. But Wagnerism is written by Alex Ross. And what did I do with the other one? Memphis. Memphis, that is written by David Less, L-E-S-S. And that'll do it for now. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thanks for listening. Back to regular business next week on Scribble.